play some cards.
From Harrah's Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harrah.
You're good, kid, but as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up.
Now, from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Welcome to show number 174, our beginning of the coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker. Hi, I am Paul Harrah. Sitting at the feature table of the World Series of Poker Room here at Harrah's St. Louis, and excited about the fact that tomorrow I get on a plane and head west to meet up with my partner Dennis Phillips, who has been living out in Las Vegas for several years and has already taken part in one event at the beginning of the WSOP. The whole thing started on Sunday with their casino employees event, a $500 event for anybody who works at a casino in Las Vegas or anywhere around the country. That is a bracelet event. And then event number two was yesterday, a $1,500 buy-in event. And that's where Dennis found himself for a few hours anyway. Right, Dennis?
Yes. I did play event two. I sat down. I looked to my right, and there's Jeff Shulman there. And I looked to his right, and Russell Rosenblum is there. And then I looked across the table, and Lane Flack is sitting over there. And they all three look at me and go, hi.
Were you surprised? Were you surprised that this event seemed to be so pro heavy?
A little bit, actually. We expected, or at least I expected, a whole lot more. They only had about 2,100 in the event. I think perhaps part of it is the timing. Starting it on Memorial Day, a lot of people, a lot of your recreational players have family obligations, other things to go on. You know, if they were out there for the weekend, then obviously it's a 2-3 day that you're hoping to play, so they couldn't stay. There was a higher percentage of pros there, and plus the pros are you know, kind of itching to get started. So a large number of them were going to play yesterday, and the field was just packed with.
So when you say there were 2,100, but that wasn't what you expected, was that also under the estimates that the WSOP folks had made?
Yes, it was. They were expecting at least 2,500 and hoping for closer to the 3,000 mark, and we were nowhere near that. I do think that'll change. I think it's the rebuy is next weekend, or the reentry, the 1,500 reentry, and I think it's going to be massive. There's going to be thousands and thousands in that one. But this first week, the first few days, they've got some of the different games going on. They've got a brand new one going on today they've never done before. So the first 3 or 4 days, you may not see the numbers that we'll expect and that you will see later on during this series of tournaments.
Yeah, I think the weekend warrior events, like the 1,500 re-entry that you mentioned, it'll have day 1A this Saturday and 1B on Sunday and then play out over the beginning of next week. I think you're right that will have a lot of people who, frankly, don't look at Memorial Day weekend as a weekend when they want to be traveling. They want to kick off their summer by taking the kids to the pool openings or whatever it may be from there on. And like me, they say, okay, you know, come Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of the first week, that's when I'll get out there if I'm going to stay for a while. Or maybe just people flying out on Friday to be the weekend warrior and just be there for a few days. I think you'll see that a lot over every weekend of the WSOP, don't you?
I 100% agree with you. People will go out there and they'll schedule their flight to fly out on a Friday and leave on a Monday. And then if they make day two, they just change their flight.
Yeah.
And they call their boss up and say, guess what? I'm going to be gone another day. Hopefully now, another 2 days.
Now, I'm curious about this because there were 2,100 people in there, but I looked online today and Elia Lesra is one of the chip leaders, but there are only 239 people left, which means for what I think is a three-day event, they knocked out 90% of the field or 85% of the field on day one.
Well, again, what you've got there, even with the good structure and the slow progression of blinds and such, you're only starting out with three times your buy-in, or in this case, 4,500, which means by the time you hit where the Andes are starting, which is level six, you need to have built that 4,500 to, you know, 9, 10, 11,000 minimum. Because if you don't, you're in a position where it's almost a folder shove type of a game that you're playing. And so those first few levels are fairly critical. You need to come in there. You don't want to be coming in at the beginning of level 5, that I did see a number of people do. You need to try and build your stack up. You need to get a little more aggressive. You need to be willing to take some risks. You need to be willing to try to win some races, in my opinion. Because if you get to the dinner break and you are sitting at under 10,000, you're not in good shape. And people played more aggressive.
Yeah, I saw a tweet from somebody who did the math and figured out that at one point in level 5, you were losing 4 players every minute.
And guess what? On the re-entry next weekend, it'll be worse.
Really?
You'll be losing more than that because you're going to have more players to start with.
Yeah.
And they're going to get a little bit friskier because they'll know on Saturday that Sunday they can rebuy. And they don't want to come back with a short stack. So I really think it'll leave anything be even more aggressive out there. I saw a lot of plays, a lot of good play. I said my lineup took me a little while. I had a couple of things to get done first with a deposit box out there and everything. I didn't get to the table till almost the end of the first level. So I was one of the later ones to sit down. I sat down in the third hand dealt when I was there. I'm in mid position and get pocket aces and go, well, this could be a good sign. I raise, folds all the way around to Russell's, who's the big blind, who just smooth calls. Flop comes jack, 4. And again, I'm feeling pretty good. Double jack out there and everything. Russell checks. I make a nice continuation bet. He just calls. Now, I've played with Russell a number of times. He's an extremely good player. That sets some alarm bells off. All of a sudden, I'm a little worried about this.
Are you putting him on a jack there, or do you think, well, he's got a pair too, and he's just seeing if I'm c-betting with things like ace-king or ace-queen here, and maybe he thinks his eights or nines are good?
It's very possible. There's a wide range of hands he still could have had. There were also 2 clubs on the board. He could have even been on some kind of draw there. Russell can play a lot of different levels, a lot of different strategies. He's extremely good. He's won a bracelet. He's the kind of guy that you need to be aware of because he's a very, very solid player. But the turn puts a queen up there, and he leads out to me. Now, I'm literally now trying to find an excuse to fold aces here.
Yep.
I can't. I make the call. It's only a $200 bet. We're only on, you know, the very beginning of level 2, so it's $2,550 on the blinds. So, you know, I make the call.
All right, let me just stop you right there. Again, let's talk about why you're making the call there and what you're putting him on, because we love to talk about strategy in these situations. So the flop is jack, 4, and a queen comes on the turn. When he bets out, you're 100% sure he does not have pocket queens, right?
Oh, absolutely. That I'm not worried about so much. But he could have called me with 2 overcards, a king, queen, or an ace, queen, in which case I'm in great shape right now because he would look at me as a continuation with a smaller pair.
And there's still the possibility that he's got a jack.
Correct. There's that possibility. There's still the possibility that he has the flush draw and he's making a stab at the pot. And that if I just have, you know, some tiny pair or something like that, then I would lay it down. I mean, there's lots of hands, again, that he could have. He could still have the nines or tens.
Yep.
You know, so it's hard to narrow him down to just a couple of hands here. So I thought about raising. I did not. I just called. And again, a lot of times in this position, I would have made a raise there to try and take the pot down. But I didn't, and the river puts another queen out there.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's queen, jack, 4 out there. And Russell makes a $600, 100% value bet.
What is that, like about a less than a quarter of the pot at this point?
Oh, no. No, remember, this is you're in the very beginning of the second level.
Oh, so the blinds are $2,550.
Right. So, you know, when I raised preflop, I only raised it to 150, and he called. And with a small blind, that only puts 3.25 out there preflop. My continuation is only a couple of hundred that he calls, and then he makes another a couple of hundred out there. So there's only about 1,400 ballpark out there in the pot, and he bets 600 into it.
Okay. And what are you thinking? Because you must have
I'm
tanked for a
I'm
moment.
I'm dead. And I'm trying to think, how can I fold this? What range of hand? Did he have a missed flush and he's making a stab at it? He's perfectly capable of that. Could he have been slow playing pocket kings this whole time? There's no way. I just cannot put him on that. An ace-queen is a definite possibility. A king-queen is a definite possibility. A jack of some sort, a definite possibility. I'll be honest with you, though. If he had a lower pair and got counterfeited, he's quite capable of making that play there to take the pot down.
Hmm.
He's even quite capable of betting 600 if he has a bare ace. He's a very good player, so there's a wide range. But my mind is going, I'm beat. I'm beat. So, of course, I called.
Was that one of those situations you looked down at your hands and your brain said, fold, 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 and your hands are putting chips in the pot?
Pretty close to it. He turned over two more jacks. He had quads.
Oh, man. I was sure you were going to tell me he had something like ace-jack or king-jack there.
Evidently, I took a little longer than I thought because Lane was sitting across the table for me. He says, the only difference there, if it was against me, you'd insta-called. So there's no way in the world you're laying that down there.
Oh.
And I got to thinking for a while, and I said, I guess not. I tried to find some way to do it, tried to figure out that for the value bet of the 600, yeah, I wanted to see the hand.
So at this point, this is the first hand you've played.
Yep.
And you're down about a third of your chips.
Correct.
Lucky to not have lost more, although, you know, there were a couple of times in there where if you just put them on a jack, you can let those aces go. But as you said, you're up against a pretty clever pro there, and he could have any of the hands that we discussed.
Yeah, I don't think I misplayed the hand. A lot of people might have been able to fold on the river against a different player. I definitely could have folded against on the river.
Well, you know that you should have folded. You knew it at the time.
I did. I'm not arguing at all. Call me a donk. But I just, it's very, very difficult, and that's it. And Lane is exactly right. Against him, I probably would have also called, and I probably would have done it just a little quicker as all.
Yeah.
But, Lane said himself that there's 100% of the time he's calling there. He says, you just can't lay it down. You may want to, but you can't lay it down. There's too many other possible options.
So I have found when I've played some of these triple buy-in tournaments, whether it's a 1K or a 1500 where you have 3,000 or 4,500 in chips, that if you have a hand like this where early on you've lost a third or maybe 40% of your stack, that is crippling enough to change your game considerably because now you're playing short stack poker against everybody else at the table. Sure, you still have plenty of blinds. You may be left with 2,900 or 3,000, and the blinds are still only 2,550, so you've got about 60 big blinds. But it changes the way you have to play against the rest of the table. And I bring this up because we're going to have lots of our listeners going and playing in these 1,500s over the course of the summer. What do you do there to adjust your play to try to kind of play catch-up?
Well, you're exactly right. I can actually describe another hand that I didn't show, and Jeff's not going to be happy when I do tell you about the hand, but it's the way you can play, and there's nothing wrong with it, I don't think. I think I played it correctly. Jeff Schulman, who was to my right, had accumulated a few extra. He had a little more than starting chips. He put a raise out there. I looked at an ace-queen offsuit, an ace of diamonds, and a queen of hearts, and I repopped it. The flop came out there with a nine high with two diamonds. He checked. I made a continuation bet of about another 500, and he called. Now I'm down to about 2,200 left in front of me. The turn card puts a third diamond out there. Now he checks. I count out exactly half of my chips, which is like 1,125, and bet 1,125 out there. And he tanks, and all I have is the ace high, but I do have the ace of diamonds. So I can portray that I have the flush. I can portray all sorts of things. And I bet the whole time through. And he finally mucks his hand, thank goodness, because like I said, all I had was ace high at the time. But you've got to play more aggressively. You've got to get the chips back. That put me back up to about starting chips, and I built it up a little bit from there. But you've got to select a hand, and unfortunately, you've got to be able to play it and play it through. If I had just checked on the turn and then blanked on the river, I'm down to 2,000. My next option is basically all in or fold almost.
Yep.
So I went for that hand, and if he had called me on the turn and I'd missed the river, I'm sitting there with 1,100 chips in front of me.
Yeah. But here's why I like the play. Because let's say he's got a pair Maybe he made middle pair there on the flop. Doesn't have top pair. I think he's got to call you there with top pair. But let's say he's just got middle pair and you shove. I think most people are going to say, I'm getting it in here against the guy who's shoving, because the shove often seems like a desperation play. It usually is not a strength tell. It is usually a weakness tell in that situation, unless you're up against an extremely tight player, a very nitty player who likes to overbet the pot. And we're going to talk about this with our guest Ed Miller later on, who's got a great new book called Playing the Player, about moving beyond ABC poker and dominating your opponents. He'll join us in about 15 minutes or so. But in a situation like that, when someone shoves in that situation, they're more often weak than somebody who does what you did, which is put chips in there as if you want the call because you've got a strong hand. I think you represented just what you wanted to represent. He, being a good player, recognized what your bet meant, or at least what he thought it meant, and made the lay down. Well, I like that play a lot.
The two things that it did, I think it's a stronger move than a shove. I agree with you 100% there. And it also makes me appear as though I'm totally pot committed, that there's not a chance in the world I'm laying this down.
Yep.
So he's not calling 1,100. In his mind, he's going to have to put 2,200 out there.
Yep.
And so it's the same as an all-in in that part of it, but it looks even stronger.
Yep.
It looks like I'm begging for a call. So, yeah, I do like that. And, again, you made a very, very good point there. You got to play your player. That's against Jeff Shulman, who's an extremely good player. I don't make that play against an amateur.
If you're up against a nit or a calling station there, you can't make that play.
Correct.
You got to check behind and hope a diamond comes on the river.
Yeah.
Or an ace.
I mean, I even my queen might have been good. You know, I could have had a ton of outs. We don't know for sure what he had.
Yep.
But I'm assuming that if a queen comes, I'm good. I'm assuming an ace comes, I'm good. If a diamond comes, I'm good. No, I'm good. So unless it pairs the board again or something.
Right.
So, I like to play, and I love the idea that he laid down. So, but anyhow, I went through a few more levels. I ran into another major cooler, a small blind, big blind type thing. The button, who was the chip leader at the table, made a raise. The small blind just called him. At this time, the levels were 100, 200 with a 25 ante. He's on level 6. The button raises it to 5 1/4. The small blind calls the 5 1/4. I'm sitting with about 4,000 in front of me right now. Not good at all. I looked at Ace King. My first impulse was to shove, but I'm ending the play right here. And the guy to my right had all sorts of tells, the small blind. Plus, he loves slow playing. I thought, I'm going to see a flop first. I'm not going to just shove it out there. I am going to see a flop. So I made what many people consider the wrong play, and I just called. I flopped an ace, king, four.
Wow.
Yeah. Yahtzee, here we go.
Yep.
Cool. My chance to double up. I'm going to be back above chip average. I'm going to be in great shape, right?
Yep.
Small blind checks. The deep stack at the table, the guy that's got 20,000 in front of him that raised pre-flop, I'm positive he's going to put a continuation bet up there. So I check, and he checks. Again, I read this so well, right?
Yeah.
Okay, turn is an 8. No problem at all, right?
Yep.
Small blind bets about 1,000 out there. Again, how can I extract more money? If I shove here, he's liable to fold. If I just call, maybe he puts me on some. There isn't hardly a draw out there. I'm trying to figure out how I can do this, how I can get more money in the pot. And I still have the wild card over there, the guy that's been raising most pots, that's been playing an awful lot of aggressive play. So maybe I can get another 1,000 out of him. I just called 1,000. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the guy on the button folds. So again, totally wrong. Right?
Yep.
River comes another 8. So now there's ace, king, 8, 8, 4 out there.
Okay.
Again, the guy in the small blind puts 1,600 out there, 100% value bet, 100% from his mannerism and everything. He is positive he has the best hand.
What do you put him on?
I had no clue. I'm going, could this be some crazy ace 8 or something like that? I mean, you know, what possible hand could this guy have? So I'm just back and forth in my mind. I'm trying to think about it. I look down. I've only got about 3,000 in front of me. And he's betting 1,600. How much of a nit am I if all I do is call him? I can't lay it down, right?
If you think you have the best hand, you got to get it in.
Right, right. Okay, I called him is all I did. I put 1,600 out there, left me at 1,525 left. He turned over pocket aces.
Oh, wow. Wow.
The problem is, yes, I might have lost the minimums. No kidding, so many different times I could have shoved it in there. But I'm still crippled. I've got absolutely nothing left in front of me. My next move, the next hand I play, is going to be just putting all my chips out there. So I guess I did all right, but I might as well have thrown them out there, I think. I don't know. I don't know if I played that well or if I played it horrible.
Well, everybody else in the world goes broke there unless you put the guy on an eight and make a hero laydown, which I don't think you can at that point.
No.
He has to have ace eight or... You know, he probably doesn't have king eight in that situation. You know, you got to put him on like 8-9 or 7-8 or ace eight. Those are the three hands. But you got to figure this guy's on ace queen, and since it was check 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 on the flop, he's you know, that's what my thinking would be. I don't think I could let it go either.
Yeah, I mean, it literally took me forever. I sat there and sat there and sat there, and I know the proper move here is just to put all your chips in. I absolutely know that. And yet this guy was so confident. I mean, every tell in the world said that he knew he had the best hand. And guess what? He did.
Well, let's go back to the flop where he checked, slow playing his top set. You checked, slow playing your top two pair. And then the guy on the button who had started this whole thing with probably what was a button steal, he checks behind. If in that situation... The first guy checks his top set, and then you decide to bet out with your top two pair. There is no way all the chips aren't going in.
Absolutely. 100% they're in. I'm not laying that down at this stage.
Or if he leads out on the flop with his top set, you're going to raise him, he's going to come back, and you're going to get all your chips in anyway. This was a situation, maybe the only way the hand could be played, that you end up with any chips left at all. I know it's nothing great there. You're left probably with an M of less than three or four, but still, I think that's the only way the hand can play, that you're left with a single chip in front of you.
I think you're 100% right. Even if the guy makes a continuation bet on the flop, the chips are going to go in there.
Yeah.
So it didn't do me any good. I ended up losing afterwards anyhow. Actually, the same guy in the small blind, well, he wasn't in small blind, the same guy to my right ended up with pocket aces, slow played him again. I had two hearts, and they flopped two hearts, and we threw it down there, and it went blank, blank on the turn in the river.
Yeah.
So he had pocket aces twice against me.
Hopefully aces cracked on your first hand of this year's World Series of Poker won't be an omen for the next 6 weeks.
I hope not.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris here at Harrah's St. Louis. Let's talk about a couple of other things that are going on out there before we get to our guest for today. I understand that they are doing something new with a system called ChipTick, a way to monitor people's stacks. What's this about?
Well, again, it was explained to me, but it hasn't been implemented yet. What they had us do, and one of the reasons why it took so long in the lineup, is anybody that was going through the diamond setup over there was having their picture taken. And then their Harrah's reward card number associated with that picture. And my understanding is they're going to put like notepads at each of the dealer stations. And when somebody comes in, then they can verify who they are real quick with a picture and that.
You mean they're going to have an iPad-like device? For each
Correct.
Dealer?
Correct.
And so
That's my understanding.
And so when you sit down and you take a certain seat, you give them your receipt, and they're going to punch you up on their thing and see your picture to verify that it's you? And
that is it.
Okay. And then how are they going to monitor how many chips everybody has?
What it is, and it's the dealer's responsibility that when somebody busts out, especially a notable, that they have to mark it or send the note on their iPad. That at every break, the dealer is going to have to go through there and look at everybody's chip stack and record everybody's chip stacks. So this should, if it works correctly, be a very accurate progression through the different levels of the players. Huh. And they'll be able to post it online. They'll be able to you'll be able to follow it a whole lot better than last year.
Wow.
I like the idea. I'm sure there's going to be some glitches on it. I think the first tournament they're going to do that with is tomorrow. I know they're not doing it today. They're going to try it, and they may do it on a limited scale to start with to see how it works.
Well, you know what? Today would have been the day to do it because the noon event, which started about 90 minutes ago, is a tournament that's capped at only 512 players, and I don't know how many they got today. It's a $3,000 buy-in, heads up, no limit hold'em, and pot limit Omaha. And by the way, my money's on Phil Galfond. I don't even know if he's entered it, but this is the Phil Galfond event as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he has to be drooling a little bit watching it, I will admit.
So that would seem to be the one that they should be putting the chip tick into action with. They only got 512 in the tournament.
Well, for whatever reason, they didn't have it ready. It was not there yesterday. It's not going to be implemented today.
Okay.
I think they're trying to get it ready for tomorrow. And I would guess that it might even be on a limited scale tomorrow, too, just
okay.
to make sure it works well and everything. But, yes, everybody's getting their picture snapped down there. We'll see how it works.
A couple of other notes about the WSOP. Phil Ivey, who did not play last year because of the Full Tilt Poker situation, said he would feel guilty about putting the money that came from the company into the WSOP while everybody else who still had money locked up online couldn't do that. Phil Ivey is back. He played yesterday in event number two. I guess after 10 months away from the WSOP, whatever guilt he felt about the Full Tilt money has abated a little bit, and I guess he's going to probably play a lot of events. Didn't make it to day two. Maria Ho took him out at a certain point yesterday. Good for Maria, but I'm sure that Phil Ivey's presence caused a little bit of a stir yesterday at the Rio.
Oh, I quite well it did. Everybody was saying that now Phil's here now, and there was also the comments at the tables. I think the general comment was, welcome back, Phil. Let's just play poker. I think most people were, moving on, shall we say.
All right.
I think they realized that he didn't make the decisions there and everything else.
Okay. Also, congratulations to Ty Stewart, who's the executive director of the World Series of Poker, who played in the Casino Employees Tourney and finished 19th. I don't know how many were in that. I don't know if 19th is in the money or not, but that's a nice deep run.
The last I saw, I think it was 724 entered it. About 46 made day two. They were already in the money by the end of the first day.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, Ty made the money. It wasn't a big buy-in, so I don't think he made a whole lot. He made $2,000 or $3,000, but he was definitely in the money. And he was having a blast. So there was some last longer among some of the other people from the WSOP, and I think Ty won all of them.
I bet he did. And let me say this. Isn't it good to have a poker player in charge of the World Series of Poker, a guy who actually enters the Casino Employees event? Obviously, he and the other executives can't play in any of the other tournaments during the course of WSOP, nor can the dealers or any of the floor people. But I think it's good to have a poker player in charge of the world's biggest poker festival.
I 100% agree. People that knows what they know what's going on with the felt. They have a feeling for it. They have an understanding for it. It's got to help
yep.
in the decision making. It just flat out has to help.
All right, we are going to be joined in a couple of minutes by Ed Miller, who's got a new ebook out called "Playing the Player: Moving Beyond ABC Poker to Dominate Your Opponents." He'll join us after a word about this room that I'm sitting in right now, the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, which this weekend crowned another main event seat winner with the double shootout format, and will do the same again this Saturday and the following Saturday and Sunday. We're going to be the first two weekends in June and still qualifying people. Even though the WSOP has gotten underway, the main event doesn't start until June 7th, so you can come down here this Saturday and enter at noon or at 3 p.m., there will be five tables set up at each of those times. You win your table. That makes 10 table winners. They all go to the final table. You win that, and you've got a main event seat. $10,000 worth of tournament entry for just a $200 buy-in. This is how Dennis got there in 08. That's how I'm going to play the main event this year. If you want details on this, go to harrahs.com/STL poker, where you can also find the schedule for all of the other events in the week. Most of the buy-ins are at 1 and 7 p.m. and are $60 events. They get a big field for those. There's also a 160 on Thursday nights and a 125 on Friday nights. But again, the main event opportunities are coming to an end here after the next two weekends, so get in on it by coming and playing. And of course, there's lots of cash action here as well in the World Series of Poker Room of Harrah's St. Louis. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. You'll find us online at finaltableshow.com, where you'll find a list of all of our 173 previous guests listed in the sidebar on the website. And you're also welcome to download our podcasts via iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or every Tuesday at 3 here on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris in the World Series of Poker Room of Harrah's St. Louis, where the Bad Beat jackpot is up to $106,000. Ed Miller is back on the show with us today. Ed is a poker coach and author. We had him on last year for his e-book called How to Read Hands at No Limit Hold'em. Now he's got a new one called Playing the Player, Moving Beyond ABC Poker to Dominate Your Opponents. Hi, Ed. Welcome back to the Final Table.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you very much.
Doing just great. I picked up the e-book last night and was reading it online, on my computer rather, and couldn't put it down. There's some great stuff in there, and I want to specifically point out here at the beginning that a lot of the strategies that you talk about in this book are geared to what I like to consider the vast majority of our audience, people who are playing in small stakes, 1-2, 1-3, and 2-5, no limit hold'em games. That's the audience that you're aiming this target, this book at, right?
Absolutely, yep.
Okay. One of the things you say at the very beginning of this book, which I want you to explain, is most poker players learn how not to lose instead of how to win. Explain that.
Sure, absolutely. Most people, you know, when they learn how to play poker, you know, they learn kind of, you know, rules that are kind of based on their cards. Like, do this, you know, don't limp in with small suited hands. You can call a raise if you've got Queen Jack. You know, you can, you know, if you get raised on the turn, you know, you should fold, and all these rules about, you know, kind of, they're all like centered on, you know, what you have and what happens to you and how not to get killed. You know what I mean? So and that's how most people play poker. They never kind of move beyond that. They're always thinking, okay, here, I have this hand. Okay, he raised. Okay, what am I supposed to do? And the fact is that if you think that way about poker, you're never really ever thinking about the other guy. You know, you're never thinking about what the other guy's doing wrong. You're never thinking about, you know, what mistakes is he making? Where is he vulnerable? Where can I try to get him to, you know, give me a whole lot of money? And therefore, you know, if you're constantly playing within yourself, looking at your cards, thinking about you, thinking about things that are happening to you, you're just playing not to lose. You know, you're not even going on the offensive ever to try to actually beat your opponents.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And there's so much information here. That was the first question that I was going to ask him. Thanks, Paul.
You're welcome.
So anyhow, there is a wealth of information at the table waiting to be gleaned, and so many people totally ignore it. I've said this 100 times beforehand. People will sit there and flirt with the waitress and start catching up on their iPad or whatever the heck it is, when there's a wealth of information to pick up there. And if you want to raise the bar, if you want your game to progress a little bit further, then you're going to have to start utilizing that information that's being freely displayed around there. That's my opinion of it. The one thing that you have in here that I like is you really, really get down to the nitty-gritty. You know, you said the other reason that players learn not to lose, it's a much lower bar to reach than to actually reaching to learn to maximize it. You say that poker players are a lazy lot. Yeah, we are. unfortunately, that's the truth. How do you, or what is the easiest way to get out of those habits and to start actually raising the bar on your game, shall we say?
Sure. So I wrote the book, Playing the Player. The idea is it's supposed to kind of shake the reader, you know, and say, you know, you know the way you've been thinking about poker up until now. Well, that's not the right way to think about it. If you want to win, there's this other way to think about it, this other way where you look at your opponents, you know, and you try to figure out what they're doing, and then you try to figure out the counter strategy and keep going after them. Well, what I say the easiest way to do is you pick one thing, one play that you're going to try to add to your game. So you're not going to say, okay, I'm going to completely redo the way I read Ed Miller's book. I'm going to completely redo the way I play poker. I don't want you to do that. I don't think that's useful. I don't think that's how people learn. What I think is best, basically, is you say, okay, I read all this new stuff. I'm going to add one play to my game today. I'm going to figure out how to use it, when to use it, and against whom to use it. And then next time I play, I'm going to look for that spot, and I'm going to use that play. And you just try to get good at that until it's part of your game, you know, and then you can do that again. So it's a step-by-step process. There's no requirement to just, you know, throw out everything you've learned and, you know, start over.
Is one of the things that people should concentrate on, and I think this is a big one myself, and I'll see if you agree, simply overcoming fear? I don't mean the fear of being a first-time player and walking into a poker room and seeing all these strangers sitting around, whether they're having a good time or they're very, very intent at the table, and you're a little bit scared because you're now putting real money on the line where maybe you were only playing play money or, you know, putting toothpicks in with your family or whatever it was. I'm not talking about that kind of fear. I'm talking about the fear that a lot of people have, even if they have been playing poker for years, they don't want to lose too much.
Yeah, I think if you go to a card room today, you know, if I walk into the Rio, I'm going to go there later today, play some poker, and I look at the people who are playing there, you know, and these people are playing for pretty big money. A lot of them have a lot of experience playing poker. You know, they've won thousands, they've lost thousands. 90% of those people play poker in a constant low-grade state of fear. Absolutely. And that's what you take advantage of, and that's what the book's about. The whole first section of the book is about how to beat tight players. People have set up this cocoon. You know, they set up their game to try to avoid losing big pots. How many times have you heard someone say, "I'd rather win a small pot than lose a big one"? I've heard it, I don't know, a zillion times. Right? That's the fear talking. I mean, I always say, like, I like winning big pots. You know, that's how I play the game.
Yep.
And it's not that I'm some crazy gambler. I'm not. I've just taken that fear and put it aside and said, that's not going to help me. But I realize that almost everybody else I play with is playing in this state of fear. So and the key is, and this is what the book teaches you, playing the player, it teaches you how to use that fear against your opponents. It teaches you how to figure out the situations where your opponent, there's a lot of situations, for instance, in No Limit Hold'em, where someone's going to make a bet, and that's the last money they're going to put in the pot. Right, they're gonna be brave for $80, and they're gonna put that $80 out there, and then they're done. If anything bad happens after that, they're gonna fold. They're gonna, you know, they're gone. Well, these are predictable situations. You can look at the board cards. You can look at that opponent. You can see what they're playing, and if you understand the game a little bit, you can recognize that $80 is the last money he's gonna put in the pot. It's time for me to raise, and that's what this book's about. This book's about trying to find all those spots that you likely aren't thinking about because almost nobody thinks this way, and saying, he's scared for that $80, it's time for a raise.
I agree with that 100%. What was Doyle's famous saying? Somebody asked him what stakes he likes to play at. I think he said, whatever level makes my opponent nervous.
Yeah. Yep.
and truer words couldn't be spoke. I'm quite
yep.
sure of that. You're talking about trying to exploit the average player, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
How do you identify, and how quickly can you identify that average player?
I identify players with accuracy very, very, very quickly. Part of that is just experience. I've just played enough hours that I can look at somebody. I can literally just kind of see their face and what they look like, how old they are, how they're dressed, how they buy into the game, and maybe see them play a hand or two. and already have a pretty good idea for roughly how they're going to approach the game. I couldn't tell you exactly how it works. You know, it's just one of these brain... It almost shouldn't work, but it does. But even so, I don't think, especially if you play live 1-2, live 1-3, live 2-5, I don't think it takes very long to kind of get these reads on people. First of all, because, as I said before, like 90% of people play in low-grade state of fear. So if you sit at just a random table, on average, 7 or 8 of those guys are going to be playing basically scared money. And the people who aren't generally stick out like sore thumbs. You know, they're throwing money around, they're making big busts, they're showing them, they're laughing. You know, the people who aren't that way have a completely different demeanor at the table. So it's really very quickly that you can identify these patterns in people and how they're going to react.
Some of the things that Ed writes about in Playing the Player are, you know, people's fear of being felted, how to win in wild games. And I don't want to give away, the whole book of strategies here, because we want people to go to your website and buy it, and we'll give information on how you do that in a couple of minutes. But I would like you to talk a little bit in depth about one of the things that you go into in the book, which I think is very, very important and not enough people pay attention to. And that is bet sizing tells. Dennis and I have talked about tells a lot on this show through the years. And when people hear the word tells, they think you're looking for an eye twitch or a neck throb or the way somebody leans back and crosses their arms. They're looking for those kind of visual tells that a player does when he's more comfortable or less comfortable. All of those things do give off information, but there's not enough attention paid, in my mind, to exactly this, bet sizing tells. Can you go into some detail about that strategy, please, Ed?
Sure. I mean, bet sizing tells are huge. I use them literally constantly. On almost every hand I play, I'm going to try to use it. At least every hand I play where someone else is doing the betting, I'm going to use bet sizing tells to figure out what's going on. The simple answer is that, you know, as I said before, you know, people come to the poker table with a whole set of emotions. Usually it's fear. Sometimes there's some other emotions mixed in. And every decision they make is sort of filtered through these emotions. Let me give you an example. I don't know how many times I've seen maybe $20 pre-flop, few people call, five ways, say. Flop comes maybe jack high with a flush draw. And someone comes out, there's $100 in the pot. Someone comes out and bets $140 into that $100 pot. Okay? Well, that is a huge bet compared to the size of the pot. And this is a bet that the player normally wouldn't make. Normally the player would bet, you know, $40, $50 into this $100 pot. Well, this one time the guy bets $140. Why is he doing that? It's because he's afraid of getting drawn out on. He thinks he has the best hand, but he's worried that if anyone calls, a scary-looking card's going to come off, he's not going to know what to do, and he's going to end up losing a big pot. So he's putting all that money out there because he wants to end the hand now. So what does that mean he's got? On a jack-high flop, it means he's got something like pocket queens, pocket kings, ace-jack. Usually it's something like that. It's like a strong one-pair hand the guy thinks is, you know, almost certainly ahead, but he's just wants to end the hand. That's what all he wants. He's like, I'm just going to take this money now. The pot's big enough. It's that win a small pot, lose a big pot mindset that makes that bet sizing tell. And then if you see the same guy, you know, maybe he bets 140 and gets called, right? And then now a scary card comes down. Now he's not going to bet, you know, the pot's now $400. He's not going to bet $500 into that pot. Once the scary card comes, he's going to bet 100 or 150. He's going to make what amounts to a tiny bet into that pot now that he's worried that his hand's no longer good. You can just look at the size of the bets compared to the situation and just kind of understand what emotions are going into that bet and therefore from that kind of deduce what he must have.
I think some words of wisdom there. We've only got a few minutes left, and I want to keep moving because you've got so much information here. the standard player now has progressed over the last 4 or 5 years from what they used to be. I wish they hadn't, but unfortunately they have. And now, you know, button raises are standard. Continuation bets are standard. All of these things everybody seems to know about. If you had to pick a play, shall we call it that, that's not being utilized right now that you think should be more, that you think people could really make some money on, do you have a particular move or play or strategy that you want to share with everyone?
Sure. There's one that comes to mind, and it's based on something you just said. Everybody continuation bets now. You know, everybody kind of knows that when you raise preflop and get called, you know, and they check to you, that you can bet and usually get away with it. What I don't see people doing so much, now this happens, you know, in online games and in tougher games, everybody who's really sharp at poker knows this cold, but in the 2-5 games that I play in Las Vegas, I don't see people doing this. You just raise those continuation bets. You just look at the board. Okay, so say somebody raises, you know, pre-flop $20, you know, one call, two calls. You know, they get two calls. Flop comes king high, like king 8-6 maybe. Okay, king 8-6, maybe with a flush draw, maybe not. Gets checked to the guy who raised. He bets $35 into 60 here, or $40 into 60. Raise that bet. Raise it to 110. The theory is they're trying to represent that king. But if you look at the actual hands that people have when they raise pre-flop, okay, they're actually an underdog to have a king or better on a flop like that. You know, they're raising with pocket queens, they're raising with pocket jacks, they're raising with ace-queen and ace-jack and queen-jack and, you know, all these other hands that don't have a king in them. So when people are continuation betting that flop, more than half the time, they're doing so planning to fold if they get raised. So that would be the number one play. I would just say try that out, you know. I mean, it's an easy thing to remember to do. You get continuation bet into, you're like, I'm going to raise you and see what happens. And that play really, really works well to kind of exploit, I would say, where a lot of 2-5 kind of regular players are today.
Well, let me put an addendum to that, and that is try it out, but don't do it every time. Just like with everything else in poker, if you do something every time, even the worst player at the table might pick up on the fact that you're doing this every time, and they're going to go, well, just like the guy who c-bets doesn't necessarily have something every time, you don't necessarily have anything either when you're doing that, and now you might get played back at, particularly by the better players at the table.
Sure.
Kind of in that thought, there's so much more three-betting going on pre-flop. And put so much pressure on your opponent. I think that's what you're looking at doing. You know, when you raise with the ace-jack and somebody three-bets you pre-flop, you know, and you've got ace-jack. Ace-jack can be beat by so many hands or can miss so many flops. You know, maybe you should be looking at position more and doing the three-betting pre-flop and post-flop in position.
Yep,
or
for sure.
Or you do it anywhere.
Are you worried, Ed, that you're going to turn more players into aggros?
I am actually a little bit worried about that. You know, I think it's the natural order of things. I think, you know, it's been happening over the last 10 years that I've been doing this. I think whether I write books or not, you know, if I write a particularly good book, maybe it'll speed things up a little bit. But, you know, it's a little bit of a concern for me, sure.
So our recommendation to all our viewers is not to read this book if you're going to play against Paul and me.
Well, you know what? I told Ed this before. I thought this with a couple of his other books, and just like when I read Dan Harrington's book on cash games, when I finished it, I went, damn it. So Ed is making money with his books, but maybe he's losing money with his books when it comes to the table. Anyway, let's tell people how they can get a copy of Playing the Player, Moving Beyond ABC Poker to Dominate Your Opponents. It's an ebook, which means you can download it for your iPad or your iPhone or your Android phone or just read it on your laptop. How do you get it, Ed?
Sure. It's also a paperback, too. So you can get it in either ebook or paperback form or both. Today, right now, you can get it by going to my website, which is notedpokerauthority.com, or if that's hard to remember, you can just Google Ed Miller Poker, and I'm the first you know, first results, so that'll take you straight to my website. You can order the book directly off my website. You can have it in 5 minutes if you want, if you order the ebook version. It's also going to be available on Amazon starting in about a week. So if you can wait that long, you can get it off Amazon. If you say you don't remember after here, and then you're like, oh, that book, Ed Miller, I remember. Let me try that out. It'll be on Amazon. But today, right now, you can go to notedpokerauthority.com and order the book.
So this is cool. You can order it on Amazon, and Ed gets the money right away, but you can't use the strategies against Ed for a full week.
Right. That's my plan.
Ed, it's always a pleasure having you on. We look forward to running into you at the Rio over the course of the WSOP. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
The book, again, is called Playing the Player, Moving Beyond ABC Poker to Dominate Your Opponents. And there is some really good stuff in there, which, as I said, I wish I had not put in a book. All right. But before we wrap things up today, I guess we need to announce, Dennis, that today is the final table from Harrah's St. Louis. After 2.5 years of doing the broadcast here, we announced a couple of weeks ago that this casino has been sold. The new owners, Penn Gaming, won't be taking over for several months. And in the meantime, Caesars Entertainment, the owner of Harrah's St. Louis, has, started cutting back on some marketing expenses. And this show is one of those. However, that does not mean the end of the Final Table Poker Radio Show. We will continue on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on FinalTableShow.com and iTunes and Stitcher Radio. We are in the process of looking for a new sponsor because we don't do this as just a hobby. We are talking to some people, and if anyone is interested, you can certainly get in touch with us through that website, FinalTableShow.com. But we also are not leaving here with any kind of bitterness because we've had a lot of fun with the people here at Harrah's for 2.5 years.
Oh, absolutely, and we need to put a kind of a special thanks out there to Denise also,
yeah,
who runs the poker room there. I mean, they've helped us out many times with a lot of different things. Hopefully we've helped them out a little bit too, but that poker room has grown. The WSOP circuit event there has grown. I think we both benefited from the relationship.
Absolutely. So we thank them, and, of course, we thank all of our listeners who will still be able to get the show on a regular basis. It just won't be me sitting here with Scott Stout, our engineer from KFNS, who handles all their remotes, with Dennis in Vegas or sometimes stopping by here as well. So, again, our thanks to everybody involved. We're 3.5 years into the show. The first year was at Lumiere Place. The last 2.5 years have been here at Harrah's. Where we go from here, I can tell you the answer to that. We're going to the Rio. I am flying out.
Paul, let me tell you, there's lots of cash games. There's lots of other things going on. I think you can find a seat.
Yep, and we'll also be doing some recording of guests, as we have done for the last 3 summers. I'm going to fly out there tomorrow with all of our recording equipment, grab some pros on Thursday and Friday, and maybe over the course of the weekend and early next week as well. So you'll be hearing our shows from the Rio probably all throughout the month of June, and we'll have stories about the cash games and the tournaments. And I think we're both planning on playing in the big 1500 re-entry event this weekend, right?
That's the plan right now. So
all right.
We'll see how everything develops.
All right. I'll see you out there for dinner tomorrow night, Dennis.
Oh, cool. All right. Give me a call when you get in.
Absolutely. Thanks to everyone for listening. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. The website, again, finaltableshow.com and KFNS and KFNS.com.